This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. Up first, we'll hear from the leaders behind a new initiative to address issues that impact the African-American community in Indianapolis. With us now are Tony Mason, president and CEO of the Indianapolis Urban League, and Willis Bright, the chair of the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis and the co-director of the Indianapolis African-American Quality of Life Initiative. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tony, I'll start with you. Can you talk about how the National Urban League received the $100 million grant from the Lilly Endowment?
Sure. Last June, I was initially contacted by the Lilly Endowment to discuss an intentional effort that they wanted us to embark on, an effort that would be transformational for the city of Indianapolis's African-American residents. And so I was asked to brainstorm some thoughts and ideas on what we could do that could work. And ultimately, I made the recommendation that since the grant amount, the $100 million grant amount, was so substantial that we could not receive it directly, that the Indianapolis Urban League would partner with the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis, but that the funding itself would be received by the National Urban League. That being that the $100 million grant amount would have ultimately changed our categorization or tax status. It would have converted us into a small community foundation, whereas that amount would not have had the same impact on the National Urban League. I also felt like it would be great for the National Urban League from a standpoint of the Urban League starting to look at and to take steps to look at how funding could be more substantial during such a struggling period of time for people all across the country, especially African Americans in cities, urban centers and locations all over America. And so they were excited to receive the grant and are excited to be a part of this initiative.
And what role does the Indianapolis Urban League play when it comes to the grant? I know you mentioned that it's kind of been given to the National Urban League to disperse it. But what role specifically are you playing?
So the role that I am specifically playing in the Indianapolis Urban League, first and foremost, is we're partnering with the Indianapolis African-American Coalition. But we're also co-administering and co-leading the effort in partnership with the National Urban League, as well as with Mr. Bright and the African-American Coalition of Indianapolis. So we play a major role in the local administration of the grant, the related efforts for the initiative.
Willis, what does the Indianapolis African American Quality of Life Initiative aim to do?
What we aim to do is to make strategic investments in five areas. The issue areas that we plan to make strategic investments in our education, employment, health, housing, and business development, African-American business development. In addition, because we also are interested in building the capacity of organizations that are Black-led, we will be doing things to both develop further leadership of all ages, and also building the capacity of organizations. We hope that the opportunity to work in the issue areas will provide an opportunity for multiple organizations within the community, both those within the African-American community, but also in the broader community, to try some new ways of addressing deep concerns and issues in the areas that I spoke to.
And this might sound like a very obvious answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why was there a need for this initiative specifically in Indianapolis?
Well, specifically in Indianapolis, and like you said, it's obvious on one hand. The reality of it is in Indianapolis and Marion County, we have nearly 250,000 African Americans, and 30% of them are poor. We know that 70% of our African-American students, our young people, fail to pass standardized exams. We have to look no further back than the recent test scores on the I-STEP I-LEARN tests for third through eighth grade in our community and in our state, where we know that less than 10% of African-American students pass those tests. We know that we have 82,000 African-Americans in Indianapolis who live in food deserts. We also know that the health disparities are staggering and have been further exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I could tell you that the list goes on. And so the intentionality around this grant provided by Lilly Endowment and the engagement of the Indianapolis Urban League, the African American Coalition, and our desire to engage the community to get, you know, their thoughts, feelings, and opinions about their quality of living and what the priorities should be is important, as well as the engagement of our thought leaders and experts sitting at the table and working with other community organizations on what the priorities should be in the areas that Willis mentioned was so important, because the challenges and the needs, the barriers and obstacles are so large and so substantial that it's going to take all of us in order to find solutions to address the challenges facing African Americans and to therefore improve the quality of living of African Americans in our city.
Willis, when it comes to the five areas that you mentioned, how was that determined that that's what you wanted to focus on?
The African American Coalition had some years ago begun to have conversations with African American residents to identify what they saw as key issues impacting the community, as well as looking at the research that's been done on social issues that has been done by multiple research and social entities in the community. And out of those conversations, out of that data analysis, we then identified those particular areas. It doesn't take an awful lot to look at the kinds of trends related to education, look at the condition of housing, to look at what has happened, especially during COVID, as it relates to the African-American community, to see not only the disparities that exist, but the lack of resources that have been dedicated to eradicating those issues. And while we believe that the dollars we bring will help improve quality of life over time, we also are not naive enough to think that $100 million, even well used and well leveraged, will in and of itself eradicate issues that have been persistent for years. But by being strategic and partnering with other entities, foundations, corporate and individuals, we hope to be directing resources in ways that can make a measurable difference.
It's funny because I was actually going to ask that question of, is $100, $100 million enough to invest into the community in Indianapolis? And my thought would be not just money is necessary, but changing the system overall. So, Tony, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, we know that we have to address systemic racism, institutional racism, and all of the barriers that exist that, frankly, African-Americans do not control. We view this grant as seed money, if you will, and that there is a substantial opportunity for it to be leveraged into additional dollars that could be invested in the initiative, either directly or indirectly, through other major efforts, racial equity efforts that are underway in our city. And so we know that there are synergies and alignment between what we are attempting to do through this effort and what is being planned and is underway through the Business Equity for India initiative. And that being, we know that there will be job opportunities and career paths that will open up for African Americans through that initiative. We know that there will be efforts in the area of procurement. And what will that mean for Black businesses and entrepreneurs? We also know that there will be a concerted focus on education and addressing the achievement gap, as well as looking at health disparities. We also know that there is an alignment and synergy between what we're doing as a part of this work and as it relates to the Corporate and Community Partners for Racial Equity Initiative, where we are working closely with corporations such as Lilly, Cummins, Salesforce, AT&T, and others to look at policy issues that need to be addressed, not only at the state legislature, but local government as well. Because we know that there are many instances where there's policy that is impacting the quality of living and the access to opportunities for people in our city. We know that through partnerships, there's potential for this $100 million grant to hopefully be leveraged into $200 million or $300 million worth of investment. We know that we cannot do this work alone. And so I know myself, Willis Bright, and all of the individuals that you're speaking with today as a part of this interview are playing a major role in spreading the word and engaging potential partners and supporters for this effort.
Well, we have a minute before we go to break. Willis, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that Tony has spoken well to what it will require for there to be change. And we're also aware, too, that it will require great coordination and cooperation between organizations within the African American community as well as individuals. One of the things that the African American Coalition has tried to do over the last 20 years is to bring organizations together to both learn together about concerns in the community as well as to exercise using its collective voice to comment on all kinds of issues or to negotiate, whether it's with IMPD or with the mayor's office or with others, to address concerns. So one of the essential elements will be not only the dollar resources and mobilizing human resources, but also coordinating and invigorating the cooperative exchange that has occurred historically between Black organizations and making sure that we are working together to be able to help affect some changes.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, health researchers talk about the pandemic's effect on their work. We're joined now by Dr. Lauren Nephew, assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Nephew. It's great to have you back with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are a physician and a researcher, and so I guess one of the big questions is, how do you balance those two roles?
Well, it could be challenging, but I love wearing both hats. As a physician, I get to see patients, to meet them, to help diagnose their problems. I get to know their families. I get to know them over long periods of time and to see them improve. And then as a scientist, I get to think about problems that may be helping or hindering them from achieving the best care that they can and how we might be able to solve those problems. So even though they're two separate hats, they work hand in hand. As a physician, I want to treat the individual patient. And as a scientist, I want to try to help figure out how I can treat a broader population of patients who may have similar issues. And so they work together, being a physician and a scientist.
And you're also a KL2 scholar. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So, you know, when you're trying to solve problems and do research studies, it really takes finances, it takes support, it takes mentorship, it takes an infrastructure. And so being a KL2 scholar means that I submitted a proposal to the Clinical and Translational Science Institute of Indiana, and they reviewed it and they said, this sounds like a good idea. It sounds like this is something that's going to advance the health of people in our state. And it seems that she has good support and that she may actually be able to achieve these goals. And we're going to support her and help her do that. And so as a KL2 scholar, you get the support of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, the infrastructure and all different groups and people that they have to help you to achieve kind of your research aims. You get some finances because research is expensive. You get mentorship, you get peer mentorship, because as a KL2 scholar, there are also other KL2 scholars who are similarly doing research projects in other areas. So you get to learn from those scholars. So it's a great opportunity to really help advance a research project for early career investigator like myself.
That's awesome. And so what is your focus in your practice, what you do day to day? And then is that the same as the research that you do? Is it tied to what you're doing?
Yeah, they are tied. So as a physician, I see patients who have liver disease. And so people who have fatty liver disease, alcohol-associated liver disease, hepatitis C, conditions like these, I see those patients in my clinic, and I see those patients really at the end of their kind of course with disease as well when they might need transplant. So I'm a transplant hepatologist, which just means that I see patients who might need transplant. Many of my patients often ask me if I'm a surgeon. I'm not a surgeon, but I do help to figure out who needs a transplant, when they might need it, and to help get them to transplant. And similarly, as a scientist, I study barriers and access to care for vulnerable populations. So populations that may have a hard time navigating care. Often that can be in liver disease. It can be women. It can be racial and ethnic minorities. It can be the underinsured. And so I'm interested in studying how can we make accessing care, getting through the transplant process, getting treatment for liver cancer, getting treatment for hepatitis C. How can we make that easier? How can we lower the barrier so that everyone is achieving equitable care?
And what was it that led you to go down this path? I mean, it seems pretty specific, the kind of work that you're doing. Was there anything that piqued your interest that got you involved?
I think just seeing health inequity all around. I think I study a very kind of specific disease, right? So I study liver cancer and hepatitis C. But really, if you're looking at barriers to care, these things can be seen in all types of areas of care. So diabetes and hypertension. And if you're a healthcare provider and you're taking care of patients, time and time again, you say, wow, I wish that I could give this patient this, but they don't have enough insurance. I wish that I could help this patient get this treatment, but I don't think it was explained to them very well. And maybe we didn't communicate it effectively. And there's some issues with health knowledge and health literacy. So I think as a physician, even as a medical student, you quickly see that there are a number of barriers to people's care. And if you could just do something about it. And so I think I began to see those barriers to care early on and really wanted to do something about the social needs and structural determinants of health that I think make it difficult for people to access care.
And you mentioned health literacy and health knowledge. Would you say that for the most part, the public isn't really health literate, or is it just dependent upon, I guess, whether people are having access to health in general?
I think that there are kind of two separate issues, and there's difficulty with both. I think that people struggle with health-related knowledge, and part of that is because physicians aren't always great at communicating effectively in a way that people can understand. And so when a patient walks away from a visit and they don't understand why they saw me, what treatment they are supposed to be considering, I consider that, you know, onus to be on us. And so, yes, I think there are lots of issues with health-related knowledge, but I think we are learning how to be better at physicians at communicating with patients effectively. And then access is different because there's some people who have really great health knowledge and can communicate very effectively with their physicians, but still have difficulty accessing care just because it can be difficult from an insurance standpoint. And some people have multiple providers for many different conditions, and it's hard even for a very savvy person to be able to navigate that system. So I think there are issues with health knowledge and literacy. There are issues with access. They can be separate, and they can both exist or they can exist independently. And I think as physicians, we're trying to do better at communicating effectively so that patients can understand exactly what's going on so they can make informed decisions.
If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Nephew, I wonder, if, for folks that might have some health literacy or seem to be, I guess, understanding what's going on, do you think that the internet creates problems like when patients come in and say, well, I read on Google, blah, blah, blah?
It can. I think I'm excited. So I won't say I'm excited. I am happy to hear when a patient is interested in figuring out what's going on with them. That makes me know that they are active in their care, they're engaged, they're involved, they really want to know, why is this happening to me? So I take that as an opportunity. I said, this is a person who really wants to learn. And then I try to redirect if there's been misinformation that's been gathered. The internet is just full of information. It's really hard to know what's accurate, what's inaccurate. So I wouldn't say that the internet has been a hindrance to the doctor-patient relationship per se, but I think it's an opportunity for me to redirect patients, to provide the right information. It lets me know that they're really engaged. They really want to know what's going on. It can require some redirection, but I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear your viewpoint on that, because I'm one of those Googlers sometimes.
I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. I mean, but we have to be careful, obviously, about the sources. And, you know, I try to stick to things like Mayo Clinic or whatever, versus these random medical websites. But the research that you've been working on, what is some of the stuff that you've done recently?
Well, right now I'm trying to understand barriers in care for patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, which is liver cancer. And so I'm trying to understand what social determinants and what social needs might impede people from accessing liver cancer care. Liver cancer is complex because people have not only cancer, but they have cirrhosis. So they have two very challenging diagnoses. And then on top of that, patients may also bring different social needs and social determinants to the table that can make it challenging for them to understand all of their different referrals, all of their different providers, all this complex information about radiation, chemotherapy, transplant. And so recently, we're trying to understand exactly what social needs do people have. Are they associated with poor health outcomes when people have a lot of unmet social needs? And then are there social needs that we might be able to mitigate from inside the healthcare system? Certainly, we can't put money in people's pockets, but can we help lower the barriers to care? Can we link people with social workers? Can we give them more health related information at a level that they can understand? Can we communicate more effectively? And so we're trying to understand which are the barriers or which social needs are most important and which ones can we effectively act on from inside the healthcare system.
And is this research still ongoing, or were you able to find some results?
It's still ongoing. What we have found is that health literacy is a big issue in our liver patient population, and that on many health literacy studies, about 60 to 70% of people have difficulty with health-related literacy and health-related knowledge. And so it makes it really hard to effectively navigate a complex system if your health literacy is low. And so knowing that, we know that we need to be much more committed to and providing information at multiple different places in their pathway of care, where they can learn about their disease and so that they can make effective choices. A lot of times people are labeled as non-compliant or not interested in care when they really just don't understand exactly what's been offered to them and what the risk benefits are of those treatments. And so now we're working on a kind of knowledge tool to help patients to better understand hepatocellular carcinoma and all the different treatment options that are available for them in a way that kind of meets them where they are.
Did you find at all that there were generational differences in health literacy? For example, maybe older generations not engaged as much because maybe back in the day they weren't given that much information?
That's an interesting question. I actually haven't looked at our data by age group. Liver cancer usually affects people who are over 50, but we probably do have some younger people in our cohort, and that would be interesting to look at. I think what we do know is how we give health information differs by age cohort. And so while you might be able to give a tablet to a younger group of patients, and they might be able to kind of look at that tablet and navigate some type of tablet-based educational programming, that might not be the best way to meet our 65 plus. They may prefer an in-person kind of teaching session, more traditional, with a coordinator to help them walk through it, as opposed to maybe a tablet-based intervention. So we do know we have to meet our patients at different places depending on their birth cohort and their experience with technology.
Is that one of the biggest challenges that you face doing this research, or is there something else that would also be challenging?
Oh, there's a lot of challenges. I think it's challenging to convince people that you can mitigate or act on social needs from in the healthcare system. Traditionally, physicians have thought that social needs and social determinants should be left to policy people. And then if we can expand Medicaid, if we can do different things from a policy level, then there's nothing really a doctor can do about your social needs. So I think one barrier is just convincing folks that just like hypertension, just like obesity, you need to identify social needs as a risk factor for a disease. And convincing folks that perhaps you can do something about it, that we are equipped to do something about it, and that if we are going to get rid of health disparities and make healthcare equitable, yes, we've got to come up with really exciting novel vaccines and medications, but if you can't get people to take them, we already see what happens, right? So you've got to be able to explain things and get people to uptake things and get people to get there. And having all the great treatments doesn't help if you can't help people to receive them. So I think there's, just convincing folks that it can be done, and then figuring out what cost-effective strategies can be implemented from within the healthcare system are the biggest challenges for those of us who study social determinants and social needs right now.
Well, when it comes to disparities in health equity, and I'm thinking about, for example, clinical trials that are done, do they accurately represent the population?
Well, that's been a struggle. So for decades, we've seen clinical trials not be fully representative of minorities and women. There's been efforts made to try to increase attention in that area, to try to get investigators to understand that it's important for our results to be generalizable, for them to look like there are study populations to look like the general population. I think I was very optimistic when I saw the vaccine studies, because those are some of the most representative cohorts we've seen in large clinical trials, with upwards of 10% of African American participant enrollment, and even higher in Latinx populations. And so for me, that showed me that this can be done, that clinical trial studies can look more like the general population when there's really an impetus. I think Moderna, Pfizer, they knew that if we were going to get significant uptake of these vaccines, that they would have to have a study population that represented the US population. And so they set out to do that, making enrollment sites in urban communities, having weekend and evening enrollments, collaborating with community organizations, and doing what had to be done. So I think it can be done if it's made a priority.
Right, and I think that's the key word, the priority. I think, for so long, it's just the systemic inequities that have been in place that created some of this. Which makes me wonder, you mentioned that women and minorities are not represented really well in clinical trials, and I don't know if this is accurate, but I've heard like even medications that you might take, the dosages are for like a typical, I don't know, 30-year-old white male, and then you're a female, and your dosage shouldn't be the same. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's complicated. I would say that, with many medicines, your gender may not matter for the dose. It may be more your size, and And so they're certainly small men, but I think that these are questions that are unanswered. I think there's probably complex interactions that happen based on gender, some based on race and different people's exposure because of their race that we're missing. And so I don't think that medicines are currently dangerous for men, for women or for minorities, because clinical trials have not had adequate enrollment. But I do think that there are nuances to medicines, how they act, what populations they may act best in, that may be missing because these populations have not been very diverse.
Well, before we wrap up, what can researchers do to improve the diversity in their studies?
It's challenging. I think it's challenging mostly because it's costly. Because really, if you're going to improve diversity in your trials, then you have to think about, okay, how many study visits do I have? Are these happening during times when people work? Can people afford to take time off work? If they can't, can I reimburse them for that? Can we have weekend hours, evening hours? For our Latinx populations, can we have translators? Have these documents been translated into Spanish? What are my exclusion criteria? Are we excluding people with comorbidity because we want to have a very safe and perfect trial? But does that make us therefore exclude many minority populations that may have diabetes and chronic kidney disease? Have I explained the trial adequately to minority patients? Or am I afraid that they're going to say no, so I don't really push in a way that I might for other folks. So I think there's things that could be done.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lauren Nephew. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today is the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. This show is not live. Up next, we'll hear from the co-hosts of After the Uprising, a new podcast looking into the 2018 death of Donye Dion Jones. We're joined by Ray Novoshelsky and John Duffy, co-creators and co-hosts of After the Uprising, and the co-founders of Double Asterisk, an Indiana-based investigative media company. Before the break, we touched on the ability to get folks to open up to you both. Ray, you said part of it was not being from mainstream media. Did that help you as well to connect with law enforcement?
look, I can promise you that our vision for this was that we were going to talk with everybody involved with this case, both on the side grieving for Donye and the side that looked into what happened and ultimately ended up determining suicide. And we were getting a little bit ignored, and we saw an opening at one point shortly after Duffy had met with Melissa, as he described. We went and knocked on the door of the lead detective. We were holding notepads and we sort of sheepishly explained who we were and that we were interested in kind of getting to know him and getting to know, you know, his side of the story. And it didn't have to happen then, but could we schedule something? And, you know, I'll leave it to the listeners to hear. There was a lot of fallout from that first moment. We ended up, there's a moment in, I think it's episode 4 of the podcast where you hear my conversation that followed with the information officer from St. Louis County. Essentially berating me, but trying to figure out what it was we were looking for. And I begged him. I said, here's what's going to happen. If you cut us out and you refuse to be involved with this because you think this is a hit job, and then down the line, this comes out and you get to complain, oh, it's this one-sided hit job, but you're making it so right now. And we don't want it to be that. And if our listeners are not able to see the police in three dimensions and understand, you know, what they went through during the Ferguson uprising and how that shaped what they're looking at and how they go into these investigations, then they're not going to see them as real flesh and blood, you know, human beings, the way they're going to see the, you know, these activists and these family members. So please help us help you. And things only got kind of weirder and more antagonistic from there. Yeah. So no, it didn't help.
Well, John, did working on this podcast, affect you at all, like emotionally, mentally, take a toll?
Yeah, in punctuated periods. I mean, it gets, you know, it comes and goes in waves depending on, you know, what's going on with it. There are moments where, you know, not a lot going on and, you know, working on other things. And then there's moments when we, you know, dive heavy into something that is happening with Melissa or out in St. Louis. And then, you know, there are just these moments of, and I don't want to spoil them from the show, but where just certain things happen that we just would never have believed. And that, it would shake me. There was definitely a moment, again, I'm being all mysterious, not being specific, but there was definitely one thing, and people will know it when they hear it, but it's a, when we discovered it, I definitely spent a night or two feeling almost like personal loss. But, you know, throughout, I think there is a, this great thing one of the sort of co-producers on the show, Matt McDonough, said when, you know, he had gotten done listening to all of our cuts, where he said by the end, he's like, you guys just sound tired. And, of course, we had we did, before release, re-record all of our voiceovers. So maybe we don't sound quite so tired in the finished product. But I think it speaks to how draining it was to spend 2 to 2.5 years banging our heads on a wall right alongside Melissa.
Because beyond even then that initial relationship with the police, as we started finding things that we felt like this could really, if you had subpoena power, you could take this a step further and maybe even find a potential culprit if this is a murder. And right, as he said, banging our heads against a wall that included, you know, a hope around the first Black prosecutor of St. Louis County, Wesley Bell, and the idea we might develop a relationship with him, our attempts working with a kind of a, you know, famous state senator named Maria Chappelle Nadal, who had represented Ferguson and first raised the issue of some of these Ferguson mystery deaths, you know, her help getting to the county council. And there was even the FBI comes into the mix at some point later in the show. And as again, without giving away too much, there were very frustrating moments that I think left John and I and Melissa reeling and unsure what to think.
Well, we won't pull any more details out of you, so you can keep it a surprise. I think, you know, I like to listen to the podcast when I'm on a walk, so I'm probably going to have to take like 3-4 walks today to catch up because now I'm very intrigued.
Well, can I just say that, because you said that first episode's hard to listen to, and I think everybody agrees, but but I think it's very rewarding and emotionally satisfying, and you get to know Danye and his family in a way that I think then as you go through the rest of the journey, like, I think it lightens a little bit. It gets very intriguing. The people that you meet and get to know are incredibly interesting. And whatever you think at any given time in a certain episode of the show, you may think the opposite in the next episode. It's a very twisty, turny show.
Well, let's pivot a little bit so we don't spoil anything else for the show so folks can tune in. John, who were the people that were helping you to put this podcast together?
In the I'm just going to laugh at her question. Because of the journey that it was even behind the scenes, really in the beginning, it was just me and Ray on a wing and a prayer. And then it was, you know, like that for quite a long time. And we reached out to a lot of potential partners in the podcast world, a lot of them, and got really close with some, potential people who would sign on and finish this out with us. And they didn't. It never worked out for whatever reason, you know, and no hard feelings anywhere, but it just didn't work out. And then in the end, we also had a lot of help on that front from our producer, Dave Cassidy, who has worked with Ray for a long time in the documentary film world. And we had some interns that helped us out from IU that came in and did a lot of grunt work for us on various fronts. And so we're grateful to all of them. And then eventually, right at the end, we thought we were just going to self-release this. We thought, like, okay, we have no distribution deal. That's fine, but we got to get this out there. And then that's when we heard from Matt McDonough from Now This, who had been interested in the story of his own volition and had reached out to Melissa. And Melissa said, oh, hey, I'm already doing this podcast with these guys. And so we hooked up, and it turned out behind the scenes a bunch of, you know, everybody knows everybody in industry and stuff, and things worked out well in that regard. Now This helped us get through to iHeartRadio.
Well, we do have a clip from Mallory Kinoy, an intern for the podcast, talking about her experience working on the show. Let's take a listen.
I just feel like the coolest thing for me was them giving me the opportunity to actually like work on the scripts and seeing the information I knew and was like, when I collected all of that, like, audio for them and I wrote all of those notes, I didn't expect them to actually let me, like, do much with it. Like, I was just handing them over the information for them to work with. But I thought it was really cool that they respected like my knowledge and my storytelling abilities enough to allow me to give them feedback on the scripts and work on some scripts and like actually use what I was telling them. So
how does it feel to hear that?
I love the IU intern program, and we continue to use it, and we've gotten so many great people from there, and some of them continue to kind of collect sort of one-off paychecks here and there from us. Honestly, it was so rewarding to, because when we started the internship, we had a discussion where we said, like, all right, we're not gonna be able to pay these people. They will get, you know, IU credits, but like, we want to make sure we're not taking advantage. They're getting as much out of it as we are. And so for them to be, you know, for us to record those credits where we named the five with the titles that they had well earned, felt rewarding that, you know, we were able to give something back to them for all they had provided.
And John, is there anything you would do differently with the podcast if you had the chance to do it all over again?
Oh, yeah, but it'd probably be really embarrassing to say it all. Ray, you go first.
What would I do differently? You know, we're debating right now if a season two would be warranted and what it would potentially be about. And I'm very so I'll dodge the question a little. I'm fascinated by what this points to in a couple areas. One, I'm curious how much more there is about any federal monitoring that was done of original Ferguson activists and Black Lives Matter activists around the country. And if there's been a lot more on that front than we might suspect up till now. And I'm very interested in the question of how much some white supremacist groups may outright overlap at times, and this is an uncomfortable issue, with police departments. Not systemic racism, but overt, you know, the Departed style, people trying to get like-minded folks into certain systems to influence those systems type of thing. So I wish we'd done more with that.
That sounds kind of scary and ominous.
Mm-hmm. I think it's scary and ominous because I think a lot of things we found maybe point towards that not being as crazy as it might sound.
Yeah. Right. Well, John, there are conversations you had. Are there any that stand out to you as the most memorable?
Yeah. And Ray, you know, he and I split a lot of the work. So we each talked to different people and sort of took different angles at times. Both of us interacted with the family heavily, but then kind of went towards our specialties. One of the things I love doing in this investigative work is kind of digging into the details of the investigation, of the technicalities. And one of those conversations that stands out to me is with Dr. Mary Case, who's the chief medical examiner of St. Louis County. And the reason it stands out to me, I think, is because it hits me harder and harder every time I listen to it, because it starts to, like, what I get from it is it's not that she doesn't care. It's just that everything is just sort of a process, and there aren't the checks and balances we think we have in some of these systems are not. There's just sort of a throughput and sort of a stamp the thing and let's move on. And so, yeah, one of the clips I gave you is of me speaking with her, Dr. Mary Case.
One of the things that we found interesting was that Dr. Case hadn't heard about the DNA swabs taken from the bedsheet.
Were there swabs or any samples taken in this case?
I don't know, but I would very much doubt it.
If I can talk to you about that real quick, when they say that she didn't come from their house, we have found in the course of our investigation that there was DNA pulled off of that sheet, and it was Danye's DNA, and then an unidentified male's DNA. But to me, the one thing that sort of stands out is that not only does Melissa claim that they just don't have extra sheets in the house, they just have enough for the beds, but her DNA is not on that sheet. They didn't find any unidentified female DNA, and she's the one who does all the house's laundry. It's pretty hard to prove a negative, like, I didn't own that. And they weren't ever told that DNA was tested on it. It was something that we found out, and then that we told them. It never made the medical examiner's report. You weren't even aware.
Well, no, we never get any of that.
But wouldn't you know that it...
We never get DNA results back. That doesn't interact with our decisions. That's not how we base our decisions.
Let's pause here for a second. This is bizarre. the medical examiner's office is responsible for determining cause and manner of death. A second or third set of DNA on a lethal instrument could in fact be the evidence they need to move a determination from suicide to homicide, or at least to undetermined. It could be the evidence they claim they are yet to see. Couldn't it?
Well, powerful.
Yeah, and then the other clip I gave you is of Deja Jones, who was a former girlfriend of Danye's, and she'd been an activist herself. And the reason it was so powerful, I think, to me is because she really hits home with why she doesn't believe Danye took his own life. And she's not a family member, and she's not does not have a good relationship with Danye's family. So it's not like she's defending them or their position. It's really what she believes.
When I tell you, when me and Danye was together, John, we went through a lot of stuff. Me and Danye went through homelessness together. We went through a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying. We went through so much, and he never once, you get what I'm saying?
Like he had been through so much adversity,
yes.
And that never came up.
No.
So
and
what would
I'm
this
saying.
Be?
Like, how would he want to do bad to himself when he was doing good? You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's what I don't get. When we were doing bad, Danye was strong as a mug. He was so strong. I was the weak one, mm-hmm. crying and, oh my God, what are we going to do? He was, babe, it's going to be okay. I'm finna get the job at FedEx. He got a job at FedEx. And like I keep telling you, Danye wasn't doing, he wasn't in a bad position. Even when he was in a bad position, he was still looking for positivity. Mm-hmm. I don't get, like I said, it don't line up with me because we went through the worst. I just can't put that in my head. I'm sorry.
Which is fair. Which is fair.
That's just not the Danye that I knew.
Well, all these clips are really compelling, and I want to know more.
Well, for anyone who wants to know more, I'd ask any of your listeners right now while they're thinking about it, pull out your phone, pull up your podcast app, whether it's Spotify, Apple, search After the Uprisings. After the Uprising, the death of Danye Dion Jones. Subscribe right now. If you get a chance, please leave comments, rate us. It all helps. It all helps for this type of work to, you know, have the potential to make an impact in the future.
What's next for the both of you after this podcast?
Well, I know this Friday, we're at 6 p.m. at Morgan Stern's bookstore in Bloomington. We're going to be speaking for an hour. They've asked us to talk as part of Banned Books Week about our experience with this and other journalism. And then, well, Duff, do you want to talk about Origins?
We have another podcast out right now that we're independently releasing called Origins, Birth of a Pandemic, also available on all the podcast platforms. You can subscribe right now. Basically, it's been a deep dive look into the possibility that the SARS-CoV-2 virus escaped from a lab in Wuhan and what that would look like. And it's based on interviews with scientists and researchers from around the world. And it sort of explores the some of the conflict of interest things that exist within the scientific world in that regard.
And for folks who are listening right now, let's say they have an idea about an unsolved case. Can they contact you? Is that something that you're dedicated to doing, or is this just a one-off?
Oh, we'll definitely hear more, and we've continued to collect stories that have come from people who've heard this podcast or knew Danye or had similar experiences with that detective Anderer. And at the end of each episode, there's a hotline that we give. So if they skip to the end of the episode, call that hotline and leave a message, we will get that message. Or go to our website, doubleasteriskmedia.com. It's like an asterisk, but there's two of them, doubleasteriskmedia.com, and they can find our contact info if they want to get in touch.
Well, thank
also
you both.
Facebook and Twitter. Yeah,
right.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. Ray Novoselsky and John Duffy are the co-creators and co-hosts of After the Uprising, the death of Danye Dion Jones, and the co-founders of Double Asterisk, an Indiana-based investigative media company. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And you can always leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.